The Bain Free Radio Hour.
Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. Today, Sean Hazlett interviews Sharon Lee on A Leiden Universe Constellation, Volume 6, Part 1. And later, One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 63.
Welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour podcast. I'm here with Sharon Lee, and we're here to discuss her newest book. How you doing, Sharon?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
Good.
All right. So this is the sixth So let's start. That's a prodigious number of anthologies. So, or collections, I guess, would probably be more.
Well, Steve and I both started out as short story writers, and we never broke ourselves of writing short stories. So it's kind of what we did for relaxation.
All right. Is there, if you kind of go back to the very first one, is there kind of a theme that has evolved over time, or like, I'm just trying to get a sense of, is this more of a progression? Is this more of a, like, are there certain phases? If you look at all six and put the sixth collection in context with the others.
The stories tend to echo the books that we were working on at the time.
Okay.
Okay, so they're kind of a history document. This volume, three or four of the stories in volume number six are about Colomino, which is, you know, Ribbon Dance and Diviner's Bow and Traitor's Leap. So you can look at them that way. But you don't have to read them. You don't have to read them in order.
Right. And anybody can pick up this if they're not familiar with the universe at all.
Sure.
And can start with it. Yeah, and should. And absolutely should. Okay. So as you look at this particular volume, what would you say the general theme of it might be?
Well, I remember apologizing at least four times because of stories being discovery stories. And that's another reason why we wrote so many short stories. Gee, I have this idea or I have this character. Let's throw them into a short story and see what they do. Mm-hmm. And also, short stories are great for figuring out plot points. So this one is fairly heavy on discovery stories. It also has some interesting deviations. There's a Leiden Western in this book. And it was a solicited story. And when the editor wrote to us and said, geez, I wonder if you guys could write me a Leiden Weird Western. And I said, no. And Steve said, wait a minute, I have an idea. So Steve was lead on that story. Finally did take both of us to write, but it's our very first Leiden Western. Mm-hmm. And
is that David Boop was the editor?
David Boop was the editor. I'm trying to, the last train out of, I don't remember the name of the star.
But it sounds Western, but it's related to like a, you know, like, I want to say it's like Kelso or some, like, I can't remember. But that's not right.
I don't remember. Wait a minute. We have a source. Good heavens. Okay.
Yeah, it'll be on the first few pages of the.
Yeah, hold on. But the first two pages have very tiny print.
Yep.
Get a boot. Here it is. So let's train out a Kepler 283C.
I got the K right and the got the K right. I know it was K something. Kepler, yeah.
So and that was fun. We also had two of the stories were delayed. They should have appeared in previous Leiden Universe constellations. They were delayed because they were either up for awards. I think both of those were up for awards, and so they couldn't be published until that was solved. And as I said, three of them are discovery stories for Ribbon Dance and Dippinger's Bell.
Now, going back to the anthology edited by David Boop, how did you, when you had to write a Western for this universe, how did you, and you know, how did you both approach that story, and what kind of things did you have to work through to make it work for the both the universe and the anthology?
Well, the Lee and Miller method had been that whoever brought a story or a novel to the table and fought for it and convinced the other one that, yes, we're going to do this, one being lead on the book. So since Steve had said, I have an idea, we can make a Western work, I went, great, go, make the Western work. and he wrote a very long piece, which mm-hmm. wasn't exactly a story, though it had chunks that we used finally in the last story, in the final version. And he finally came to me and said, all right, we might have bit off more than we can chew because I've got all this stuff, but I can't yank it together. And I said, okay, well, let me think about it. So, and at that point, we went on vacation. So I'm wandering around in Algonquin, Maine, on the beach, and I'm straightening my hat. And in this particular story, there is a weatherman, and the weatherman communicates with the ranchers through their hats. So he sent them weather reports. So there's a derecho, you have to, you know, get out of the weather. They communicate with him, he feeds them news. And so I'm walking around the beach and I'm adjusting my hat and I went, wait a minute, I've got it. I've got how to pull it all together. And came back to the room and sat on the balcony with Steve and waved my hands as I usually do. And I said, it's the hat. We've got to get Dale, the weatherman, more into this story because the hats are the key. And he went, okay. I was going to get rid of the weatherman because I thought he was extraneous. I said, no. He's the one. He's the linchpin. This makes all this work. And the other piece that makes it work is the Leiden universe is a universe. So a Western world is definitely possible. It says it can't be a ranching world. And Leiden's are the best lawyer accountants in the universe. So, and naturally, ranchers will need lawyers and accountants. So they have a Leiden accountant come down. He's doing his master's work, and he's decided to study the economy of this particular Western world and try to figure out if things can be done differently or why things are being done the way they're being done. And this becomes his specialty. He goes back home in the same system, different planet, and about 10 years, he's made friends on the planet, he's learned stuff. He goes back home, he's working in the firm, 10 years pass, his boss comes to him and says, we have something for you, it touches on your specialty. And for a minute, he can't even remember what his specialty is. And then he remembers that it's the economy of this weird world. And he is sent to where a property never goes on sale, except someone's selling their ranch. And that's very strange. So they he goes to find out how this is happening. And he is the second pin for the story that makes it work. And we had a lot of fun going back and forth in time. And are you going to indulge me? Please indulge me.
I will absolutely indulge. The whole point of this interview is to indulge you and to sell the book.
Okay, well.
So if you can do both, that's fantastic.
He was big and strong and peaceable. Nobody was accepting a fight. Nobody expected him to knock down one deputy, much less two, or take off running. And if they'd ever thought about his pony, they sure hadn't expected the bolt of hoofed lightning that answered his whistle, nor the ease with which a big man could swing into a saddle from a dead run. Meld and Questa were gone before the second deputy lumbered to his feet, out of town and on the wrong end of the law. Now I ask you, is that a Western?
That is definitely a Western. So did you have fun? Did you and Steve have fun doing it? At first, when you approach it, were you like, it sounded like you were like, oh my God, no. And then you kind of figured it out, right?
We figured it out. It was fun to figure it out. And it was fun to meet the characters. And Steve figured out where space leather came from, which, you know, we've been having people wear space leather for ever since Agent of Change, in the 40 years. And, you know, people would occasionally say, well, space leather, what? Leather made out of space. So this story tells you where space leather comes from on top of everything else. So there.
Now, did you come up with where it came from in that story, or did you kind of know many years ago you just had never worked it into something?
I had never thought of Hodums, which is where space leather comes from.
Say more. Hodums.
Hodums. Hodums are... Okay. Hodums are these alien animals who produce what is then worked into space leather. And they have spines, so their hide kind of hangs on these spines until it gets too heavy, and then they drop. And at a certain season, most of the herds lose their leather, and so that's called drop season. And all the ranchers go out with the, and the aerial patrol goes out, and they gather up the leather and take it in to be worked and made into space leather and other durable goods. Steve made these animals up for this story.
How did he have like an inspiration for them? Like a precedent or did he just pull it out of the ether?
If I knew how Steve's mind worked, I have no idea.
Well, I mean, it seems like it was fruitful for sure.
It was fruitful. And I'm like, how did you know, these animals? And he's like, well, leather's got to come from someplace. I'm like, okay, fair.
That's fair. Very logical. Now, you know, I hate to ask you to pick winners here, but do you have a particular favorite in this collection?
In this bunch. Oh, this is hard.
If I have to pick one,
I'll pick Standing Orders.
Okay. And then why is that your your favorite, but why?
The Lee and Miller system. The Lee and Miller system was whoever was lead on a book did the book. And the other partner did real life and also fulfilled any short story contracts that came to us during the time the book was being worked on. Standing Orders was mine to write because Steve was working on Fair Trade. It was mine to write. I had just finished radiology and treatment for cancer. And during all that excitement, I had forgotten how to write. And here we had a short story on deadline. I'm like, no, I can do it. And it took months. It took months. I had to re-teach myself how to write. I did, I don't know, 50 drafts of stories that just were impossible. And got up one day and walked to my computer and said to Steve, if it doesn't work this time, I'm just going to contact David and tell him we can't fulfill the contract. And I sat down and, again, indulge me. Just doodling around as one does on the keyboard and doing the, you know, okay, this better work. The war was over. The admirals had prevailed. The enemy was vanquished. Mankind was safe. Some people would think that was a good thing. Some people don't know much about mankind. And that was
the first story in the anthology, I think, right?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it's actually a fantastic line to even start on in the first. You definitely thought that through, didn't you? Or is that random that was arranged that way?
The arrangement in the anthology.
Yes.
It was either that one or The Last Train to Clarksville because of the beginnings of both of those. But anyhow, that little prose poem was the kick I needed. And suddenly I went, oh, Maggie Rootfear. Who the hell is Maggie Rootfear? I have no idea who she is. And I remembered that I don't have to know. She knows. And all I have to do is sit here and let her tell me.
So when you say you forgot to write, what does that entail? Like, I know it's like trying to describe the indescribable almost, but can you at least, are there like sensory things that you can point to or any examples you can point to of what that struggle was like? Because there might be budding new writers that are struggling with the exact same thing and are trying to break through that wall. So can you kind of describe, I guess, symptoms is what I'm looking for, like what the symptoms were, and then what that breakthrough was. It seems like the breakthrough was the, instead of trying to put it on yourself, you put it on the character, and that was the breakthrough. Yeah,
just relaxing into it. This is not my story. This is her story. So who knows better what it is. Which is, again, the Lee and Miller method. You find a character wandering around in your head, and you say, so what kind of trouble can you get into? For me, because cancer takes up a lot of time. The treatment takes up a lot of time. And doctors want you to focus on real life really hard. There are what ifs, but there are no what ifs that you can play with. There's you can treat it or not treat it. You can, you know, but these all have real world consequences. You can't just make up a better ending. And I had gotten, I'll say, mired in real life. I mean, I forgot that there are, when you're making things up, the sky's the limit. And I had also forgotten what I said before, that it's not my story, it's the character's story. And it has always seemed to me when I write that somebody is telling me this story and I'm just writing it. I reread everything I've written the morning before I start my day's writing, and I'm often surprised by what I've written. And actually, I'm rereading the entire Lead and Universe series, and also Doomfey and Long Eye, because I've never been able to reread all of my work. And Doomfey, most astonishingly, but also the Crystal books in the Leiden universe, I was reading them and saying, my God, this person is good.
And you're like, did I write that? Like, yeah. Right?
Right. And how on earth did I think of this? Yeah, it's not ever, I mean, I write letters. I don't write short stories. I don't write novels. That's what the genius of the place.
What is your process for, well, let's start with the short story, because I'm also curious about the novel, if there's any differences, but what is your process for writing a short story from like idea incubation to final polished draft?
Usually it is. I've noticed a character. Usually, very often the characters in the Ligeti short stories anyway are bit players. And I want to know more about them. So I'll write a short story because they're never going to be in a novel, except for when they are. And they're an interesting person, and I want to find out what they're doing. How did they get there? Where did they come from? And so I ask. That's easy enough to do. Sometimes you get pieces. I have pieces of stories laying around here that occasionally I'll pick up a piece and pick up another piece and then go, oh, these two go together, written 5 years apart. But one of the very real things about writing is that you keep growing. And there are stories that you might think of and stories that you really want to write that you're not old enough to write yet. And so you set them aside and come back to them a little later. So, but for me, it's almost always the characters.
And do you, it's, I mean, I think I know the answer, but I don't want to presume. Do you outline the story beforehand, or are you the classic pantser?
Outline the story. Yeah.
A classic pantser. Yeah, by the seat of your pants. Yeah.
I'm so bad. It goes back to high school when you used to have to hand in the outline before you wrote the paper, and the teacher had to.
So you would write the paper before you wrote the outline.
I would write the paper, and then I'd extract the outline, hand in the outline. You know, then I'd be done.
I can imagine it would have been stressful because they probably didn't give you very much time to write the outline, and you had to get the entire paper done.
Yeah, well, you know, you work with.
Okay, so compare that process for the short story. Is it any different when you write a novel, or is it the same?
I just finished writing a novel with like 5,000 characters in it. And it's a sequel. I wrote the sequel to Salvage Right. It's called Kim Wright, and Tonya is reading it, and you know. But I started that book out knowing that I'm old and I owe my characters something, right, for having called them into being in the first place. And I don't want to leave them in a place where they're not, where at least they don't have a base. I mean, these are very trouble-prone characters, so I can't say, well, I have to leave them safe. No, that's never going to work.
Right. But it's not interesting if they're safe, right?
No, they're never going to be safe. These are not safe people. But they do need to know who they are. And they need to know that they have each other's backs. And so this book, Kim Wright, was about Kim pulling in and saying, all right, we are very thin. We are not a big clan. We're a dozen, maybe a dozen and a half people. That's all we are. Are we going to just split up and marry into other families? What are we going to do here? And they decide to hold together as a family and to try their expansion in other ways. But the process of deciding to be a family instead of just saying, yeah, we're kin because we were all born in the same family, but the process of making that decision took up a lot of the book, and it was important work because people don't realize how important other people are to them a lot of times.
Now, in terms of kind of the world building in this collection, you know, you kind of mentioned earlier that you used the short story process as kind of discovery writing for larger novels. What aspects of world building would you say are more pronounced in this particular volume than in the others? Like, is it the differences between the AIs? Is it,
This one, because of the three stories that are so closely related to Colomino. Colomino is a really fun place. It's Psi Powers work there. And the reason they work there is because there's this ambient condition that allows anybody with the least little bit of talent to amplify what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really fun to write in that particular setting, but you have to be careful. And yes, I'm going to say this, and people out in the audience are going to go, she said that. You have to be careful not to jump the shark. You have to be careful that you're, you have a teleporter, but it has to be realistic. You can't have someone teleport across the world in a thought. Actions take energy, they take calories. You have to break your journey and eat something. And rest. So putting limits on that kind of stuff was part of what we were trying to work out with the short stories. And also, once again, characters. Okay, this character is doing this. Why? This is the situation we came to in the novel, but we need to find out where that came from so we can write about it believably, even if all that basement stuff never gets into the book. We have to know we're on solid ground.
Now, are there any stories, and the story we already talked about might fit the bill, but there might be others, that you would consider more experimental, right? So certainly the Wild West part was experimental in a way, right? Because you're exploring a completely different genre than anything you've written in the Liadine universe before. Are there any other stories like that? And it could be, you know, experimental in however you define it, would you say, they're in this anthology?
I'm glad I brought this to the desk.
Feel free to indulge, no need for permission.
One of them, Our Lady of Benevolence, we had written a bunch of stories because Bain had asked us to write a Christmas story. They asked us to do this several times, but they asked us to write a Christmas story. And our first reaction was, but Liadines don't have Christmas. But then we remembered that Liadines have Milanti plays, and Milanti plays are probably... probably some Milanti plays would make good Hallmark stories. Mm-hmm. So we wrote a Hallmark story, and it was about a guy who shows up on Shorblake, and he's got, a dozen kids with him. And he's been brought in by the Mercs. He's been evacuated by him and the kids have been evacuated by the Mercs from another planet and brought to Shorblake because the Mercs figure they're Korvol's problem. And it turns out that he is a baker. And he starts teaching the blocks because...
And now, as promised, one jump ahead. John Moore is a nanotech-enhanced soldier of fortune. Lobo is an AI, a living weapons and intelligence platform of enormous destructive potential. Two very dangerous wolves in a galaxy of deadly corporate and paramilitary predators. But Moore has grown weary of the killing, and just once he'd like to finish a job without leaving a trail of blood behind him. Not going to happen. Not on a pristine planet called Mackin, where two gigantic corporations vie for control of the local jump gate and access to the riches of an undeveloped world. Dealing with a kidnapping and extortion scheme is only the beginning for Moore and Lobo as they work to stay one jump ahead.
And I realized it was Lim. She shook me gently with one arm and called my name. I felt her other arm moving, but couldn't tell what it was doing. Before I could answer her, my arms were free. I lifted my head for a quick look down my body. She'd cut the sections of plastic that had bound me to the table. "John," she said, her voice harsh and forced, her breathing ragged, "can you hear me?" I nodded and managed to squeak, "Yes." "Good," she said. "We have to go. Can you stand?" I heard her words. I could repeat each one. I even knew I should understand them. The problem was that I couldn't focus enough to make sense of them, to transform them from sounds into meaning. I squeezed my eyes shut in an effort to concentrate, and then she was shaking me again. "Forget standing," she said. "Try not to move when I lift you. This'll be hard enough as it is." She crouched beside the table, facing up my body, her head near my waist. She grabbed the far side of me and pulled me onto my side. She tugged me a little farther, and I rolled onto her shoulder. She grunted and dipped slightly as my weight hit her. Movement was strange. At first, a freeing sensation, and then a nauseating one. As my stomach hit her shoulder, I heaved and threw up. "Lovely," she said. "The amount you owe me just went up." Bracing herself with one hand on the table that had held me, Lim stood. I felt her arm holding me on her shoulder, and she leaned down on the side away from me. My nose smacked into her body with her first step, and without conscious thought, I turned my face to the side. She walked carefully but quickly. I bounced with each step. The only colors I could see were the green glow from the emergency strips and the soft yellow of the thin tubes that ran down the other arm of the suit Lim was wearing and into the weapon that looked as if it had grown from her hand. Lim kept me near a wall as we went, my body bumping into it every now and then. The bumps didn't feel good, but I also couldn't quite register them as pain. They were simply more sensations that my overloaded body interpreted as distant and irrelevant. We progressed along a hallway. Here and there in the darkness, I caught glimpses of bent and scorched sections of walls. My nose itched from the smells of charred plastic and singed metal that thickened the air. Three times, Lim passed men lying on the ground. None moved. I caught a clear view of only one. His head tilted at an angle that even in my condition I could tell was unnatural. And in his chest, a hole bigger around than my arm was black and oozing, the smell so strong I vomited again as we passed him.
"Damn," Lim said. "You'll pay for this."
The effort of speaking while carrying me caused her to pinch each word. A few times everything went black. Each time, I couldn't tell if we'd entered an area with no lights or I'd passed out again, and each time, I have no sense of how long I remained in total darkness. We rounded a corner and stopped outside a door that displayed both the usual green glowing strips and some additional red lights. I knew if I could clear my head, I'd remember what those other lights meant, but I couldn't manage it.
"Open both airlock doors, Lobo," Lim said, her voice low and strained.
The door opened, and Lim stepped into a little room. A second door opened, and light slammed into me, everything so bright I had to shut my eyes. I felt Lim take a few steps forward, then she crouched and shoved me off her shoulders. I fell for an instant alone in the air, and then I hit the floor. My stomach heaved again, but I was empty and nothing came up.
"Get ready to get us out of here," I heard Lim say. "I'll be back in 2 minutes."
Her voice was a whisper that reached me from what seemed an impossibly far distance. The world lurched, and I passed out again. Sunlight warmed my eyes. I tried to roll over so it could work on my back, but I couldn't. My arms and legs were stuck. A torrent of memory erased the sun and tore me from Pinkleponker back to... where? I was lying down, unable to move, wondering if the voice would know I was conscious again. When the last strand of memory played across my mind and I remembered Lim and the rescue, I opened my eyes. I was indeed back in Lobo, in the small medical room, on the same bed where I'd secured Chung, held by the same restraints I'd used on him. An IV trailed out of my right arm. I tried to call for Lobo, but all I managed was a croaking sound, more like a cough than a word. It was enough.
"I'm glad you're back, John," Lobo said.
Lim entered the room.
"Finally," she said.
I closed my eyes, held them for a couple of beats, then opened them again. I was still in Lobo, and Lim was still standing there. After a couple more croaks, I managed to say,
"Water."
Lim swiveled a tube to my mouth. I sucked on it, gently at first, letting my mouth and throat reacquaint themselves with liquid, and then harder, drinking all I could manage. I turned my head away when I was done, and Lim removed the tube.
"Thank you," I said.
The tube dripped a bit on my cheek.
"You're welcome,"
Lim and Lobo each said, Lobo a syllable ahead of her.
"I scanned you," Lobo said, "and found no implants or broken bones. All your organs are functioning at least tolerably, though you were dehydrated. So we've loaded you with fluid and some broad-spectrum repairers, but only generics. Can you give us more specifics on what they did to you?"
"No," I said.
"What you've done is all I need. Well, that and some time.
I wanted to be better prepared the next time I encountered these attackers, and I was now convinced there'd be a next time.
Did you take blood samples?"
"Of course," Lobo said. "We were prepared in case my treatments proved to be inadequate to revive you and we needed to seek additional medical aid."
"Keep them," I said, "so I can study them later."
When I had more energy and some private time, I could work with my nanomachines to provide my body with resistance to these drugs. Having more energy seemed a distant proposition. I felt very tired, as tired as I could remember ever being.
"Can you stand?"
Lim said. I nodded, then said,
"Give me a moment."
I closed my eyes and focused on instructing the nanomachines. For the first time since my kidnappers had tagged me on my way to the busted heart, I could concentrate. I set in place a full body cleaning regimen, something I've had to do all too many times in my life, and then took a deep breath. I was back. I'd hurt for a while as the nanomachines cleaned me and my body had to purge the waste, but as long as I drank a lot of water and rested, I'd be back to normal within a day or so. I opened my eyes, looked at Lim, and said,
"I can stand. Please, let me up."
She removed the IV and undid the restraints, then stayed close as I sat up slowly. I put my hands on either side of my body and gently swiveled my legs so both hung off the side of the med bed nearest where Lim stood. I felt beaten, almost shattered, but in a dull way, with no sharp pains, so I was confident no bones were broken. I rested for a moment. Lobo helped by lowering the bed until my feet touched the floor and my knees bent slightly. I pushed off the bed and stood. I wavered for a few seconds, dizzy and weak enough that I closed my eyes unconsciously as I struggled for balance. The dizziness passed, and I opened my eyes again. I tried to step forward and almost fell. Lim's hands on my arm and shoulder were all that stopped me.
"Perhaps," I said, "I should sleep a bit more."
"Idiot," Lim said. "Of course you should sleep more. Get back on the med bed."
"No," I said. "My bunk." Lim scowled at me. "Please."
After a short delay, she said,
"Okay,
but you're definitely an idiot. She ducked under my right arm, and I held on to her shoulder as we made our way out of the small medic area and to my bunk. I moved like an ancient patient too proud or too stupid to let his nurse have the bed transport him. And in a humbling moment of self-honesty, I realized that at the moment, that was all I was. When we reached my bunk, Lim lowered me gently into it. "Thank you," I said as I closed my eyes, "really, for everything." I fell into a deep sleep before she could respond, a sleep blissfully devoid of dreams. Chapter 24. I awoke thirsty and ravenous. I drank a liter of water and ate quickly, staying alone, taking stock internally. I felt almost 100%, the nanomachines and the meds having done their jobs. When I finished, I went up front, where Lim was scanning shimmering windows of information about Mackin and Kelko's presence there.
This has been the Bane Free Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us at the heart of science fiction. Join us next week as Sean Hazlitt's interview of Sharon Lee on Aliadan Universe Constellation Volume 6, Part 2, continues. Then we'll have One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 64. Score by Ruth Judkowitz.